Long day. My name is Barbara Anderson. I'm a very grateful Al-Anon. And I think when I think about all that we've heard so far, it really is like a patchwork quilt of story, continuous story. And when we were thinking about what to do for this particular meeting, a missing element of it was the family and the hopeful result of how far we've gotten in the steps so far, getting through nine, is to give and receive forgiveness. And so we're going to be talking about forgiveness. I'm very tickled this afternoon to be able to share on the same podium with my new sponsor, Linda. I still have my old sponsor while she's around, but she told me I needed a backup, and I'm very honored that Linda is that. And two of my sponsees, Leslie and Lou, are also here. So the program works, and generations of sponsorship work as well. We're going to be talking about forgiveness, and I want you to think just a minute about your own life. How many of you in here, and you don't have to raise your hand, but I want you to think about it. How many of you in here today have somebody in your life you wish would forgive you? How many of you in here have someone that you know you have yet to forgiven, to forgive yourself? Anyone had a sleepless night in the last month as a result of relationship not going well? Okay. So there's many aspects of forgiveness, both looking at receiving it and forgive and being able to give it. And in the process of working the steps through nine, the hopeful result would be that those people we've made amends to would meet us in the middle and would be able to forgive us. But I know in my own life there have been times I've done my own work and I've gotten through my night step amends with somebody and I'm stuck out in the middle of the street in oncoming traffic. And it can be pretty scary. And sometimes making amends when we're not sure what's going to happen on the other side is like that. I am very honored to tell you my anniversary date in this program is March 19, 1984. I have been around here for a while, and what I've seen over the years is there's many people that come into Al-Anon and think that somewhere along the line we're going to be handed the miracle answer of how to keep somebody else sober. You know, that it's kept in the back secret vault, and if we stay around long enough, what happens is too many people come to Al-Anon and leave before the miracle happens. They leave before they really work the steps. They leave before they realize that it also has to do with them and before they do their own work. In working with a lot of Al-Anons over the years, I've realized that there's basically four P's for why people don't forgive, particularly that side of the family that you're so concerned about. First one is about protection. You know, if I forgive you, you may hurt me again. And there's that ultimate fear of, oh my God, I can't do this because I'm vulnerable again. I might be letting my wall down. I might be tearing it down, and I might be vulnerable to you again. The next one is about power. You know, if I don't forgive you, maybe you'll march to my drummer for a while. Maybe if I can manipulate you in some way by not forgiving you. The next one is pride. And I think often we don't forgive someone else because we're waiting for them to make amends to us. We're hanging out over here. When you make amends to me, then I'll do it. But you have to go first. You know, your transgression's worse than mine, so I'm hanging over here. And the last one is punishment. You've hurt me. And I'm going to hurt you. I'm not going to forgive you. I know that I've met people in both programs that have really struggled for many years with, you know, they get mad at somebody and those people cease to exist. Maybe they move groups, home groups. Maybe it's before their program altogether and they do geographic tours, whatever. There's that tendency to pile up our resentments and our coffee pot and move somewhere else. But forgiveness is a true miracle when we can find it. I want to share with you my 12 steps before Al-Anon. It may give some of you insight into, before I say, how many of you are in Al-Anon that are in this room today? Great. Okay. And how many of you have never been to an Al-Anon meeting? Welcome. I promise we won't bite. Anyway, these are my 12 steps before Al-Anon. Number one, I discovered that I was powerful over others and that your lives were certainly unmanageable. Two, came to believe I was the power over you that could restore you to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of me. Four, made a searching and fear-filled inventory of everyone that I know and found them lacking. Five, admitted to God, myself, and anyone that would listen the exact nature of your wrongs. Six, became entirely ready to assist you in removing all your defects of character. Seven, assisted you in removing your defects of character, except when to do so would cause me harm. Eight, made a list of all persons that had harmed me and vowed to get even with them all. Nine, waited for everyone to make direct amends to me. 10, continue to take your inventory and when you were wrong, promptly pointed it out. 11, sought through martyrdom, mothering, managing, and manipulating to improve your conscious contact with me, asking only that you read my mind and carry out my wishes. And 12, having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of this type of living, I tried to drag all those I love down with me and get sympathy and pity from all who would listen. Now, guess what? That's the opposite of forgiveness. But it took me a long time to be willing to even peek beyond that set of steps I had really built for myself. I would never have told you I was like that when I came into Al-Anon. I came from a long line of alcoholics. I was almost everyone I was in relationship with was either alcoholic or a child of an alcoholic. I'm very blessed that I didn't marry one until I found a sober one. And Dick told me when we started dating, he would not marry anybody unless they were in Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon to manipulate him into marrying me. And it worked. But it took me coming and listening almost a year and a half before I even began to look at the steps for myself. And I'm very grateful that I did. I'm going to turn this over to Linda, and we're all going to share a little bit about our forgiveness story, and then Leslie and then Luke.
Thanks, Barbara. My name's Linda Bazance, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I asked if I could go first because I don't have a profound forgiveness story. But here I am on a forgiveness panel. And obviously, over the years, there have been a lot of people that I've had to forgive, and there have been a lot of people that have had to forgive me. I just don't have what I would call a real profound story. I love that this fellowship and the sponsorship line. I have had the privilege of having three sponsors in my life. The first one was Genevieve, second one from St. Paul, Minnesota. Second was Marcy White, Marcy W. from Whitney, Texas. And after those two passed, my sponsor right now, her name is Beverly R. from Fort Worth, Texas. And, you know, I stand on their shoulders. And as we all stand on each other's shoulders in this program, the sponsor becomes the sponsee, and back and forth is the way it works for me. So I'm privileged to be with these three people today. Forgiveness for me, one of the things that I still struggle with is my relationship with my mother. And my mother has passed away, and I'm an only child. And I wasn't a bad only child. I mean, I wasn't a bad kid. I was just one of these kids that my mother was the safe place to be critical. And you know how you just wish you could have a day back, just one day, when you could just really say, I was a real jerk. And I get that feeling over and over and over. And so one of my issues or one of my challenges or one of my privileges is to continue to try to forgive myself. And as I get older, I become more like my mother. So the things that I was irked about or critical with her, oh my goodness, I'm doing them. And it's just a real interesting place, and one that, like I said, it's not real painful, but at times it is. Because don't you just wish you could just change something? And the only way I can change that is to not be critical with you. And to see your flaws, and instead of pointing them out, to allow them to be. And to have a gentle touch with them. So that's not a real profound story, but it is part of my forgiveness. The other thing I was thinking is, you know, I've been told or heard or learned that anytime I'm disturbed, I either need to forgive or I need to make amends. Because there's something going on with me. And the more I'm in this program, thank goodness, thank God, because I'm working the steps, I don't have as many forgiveness issues. Because I've got step 10, and I keep cleaning it up. And I also have this thing that goes off in my head, and it's almost like a bell. When I'm starting to act like a jerk, or I'm starting to have an opinion that is negative, I get at this, no. Like Mari said, you know, I don't want to stay in gossip. Gossip is not a neighborhood I can afford to go to. Now, I have a proclivity for getting into it on occasion. But boy, I don't stay there long because it's not good for me. So the longer I'm here, and I've cleaned up a lot of messes. I've been around for 44 years. So, you know, I'm not a big mess maker now because I don't like to do amends. But I want to keep it clean. I want to have peace of mind. And when I get disturbed, I look at whether I have to make an amend or whether I have to ask for forgiveness. And I'm going to pass it to Leslie.
Hi, I'm Leslie Mathis. I am very, very grateful recovering Al-Anon, and I'm very honored that I'm on this panel with you today. What I'm going to tell you is just a bit of my story so you'll understand where I'm coming from. I was born into a family that my mother was an untreated Al-Anon, and so she has all the isms that so many of us have, and she is also a prescription drug addict. She is that to this day. She's still alive. She's 78. She came from a very large family. And my father came from a very large family also. So as a result of that, what happened was my father was the one that was more like Al-Anon. And, of course, my mother was the one that was more like an alcoholic. So as I'm growing up, what happened was with my mother, I never, ever knew what to expect. And it was a little different than alcoholism because, you know, you can kind of tell when somebody's drunk, right? You can't always tell when somebody's taking too much medication or whatever. Okay, so what happened was I never knew what to expect. I was exposed to continuous conditional love. If I was not being her puppet and doing exactly what she wanted, she withheld her love from me. And she was always right, and I was always wrong, no matter what. Didn't matter what it was. As a result of that, I always had to be the one to approach her. I always had to be the adult and say, I'm sorry, let's kiss and make up. It didn't matter what it was. So I learned that I was the one that had to always be wrong if I was going to get along with my mother. And if I didn't, it was hell in the house. So it just, you know, how are you going to win that fight? You can't win that fight. The other thing that happened was I absolutely had no freedom whatsoever to have my own thoughts, ideas, feelings, friends whatsoever. She dominated and controlled every bit of my life. So that was on the one hand. On the other hand, what happened was is my father was telling me that my mother was the very best friend I would ever have and to honor, love, and cherish her. And I was just, by that point, I was messed up. I'm like, if this is the best it's ever going to get in the way of friends, I don't need friends. And so I wound up very, very angry as a teenager, extremely angry. I fought all the time. People were scared of me. It was nothing for me to walk up and just punch you out or cuss you out. You know, I could use my body and my words in a way that you knew that you just didn't need to mess with me. In fact, in high school, I found the very scariest woman that I could find, girl, whatever. And so I knew that if I was going to be scarier than her, I had to beat her up, right? So what happened was is I provoked and provoked and provoked her to get her to hit me so I wouldn't start it. So when she hit me, that was my green light to just clobber her, and I did. Got suspended, and that wasn't good. But as a result, I got this nickname named Bruiser. I don't know if I've ever told you that or not. So through high school, my nickname was Bruiser. this is what happened, too, is whenever we had story time, that's kind of what I call it now. It wasn't like this official story time that you sat down, but anytime my mother would tell me a story about anything that happened in her past, what would happen is what she would tell me is a story about her lifetime of grudges, her lifetime of resentment, her lifetime of how this person did her wrong, and she is better than that person, and she never knew about letting go of anything. Never. Forgiveness was a foreign language in my house. I knew nothing of that. So it really became ingrained in me that was, as a model, you know, as using my mother as the model, that's what I came to believe we were supposed to do. So then what happened was that I became very self-righteous. I became very judgmental. I never, ever learned to say I'm sorry anymore. Because once I got out of the house, you know, she was a little beside. I didn't have to say I'm sorry anymore. I didn't have to bow down to her because to me that was weakness and I didn't have to do it. I also got this attitude of I'm okay and you're very, very wrong. The situation had nothing to do with it whatsoever. It was if something happened, I was okay and you're very, very wrong. I walked around like that for better than 20 years. Long, long, long time. Jack was talking this morning about rocks. Mine became more like shiny diamonds. So I would go around and I would collect these shiny diamonds. And I would collect as many of them as I could of all shapes and sizes and put them in my backpack and carry them through life. They were very, very precious to me. Extremely precious. That was what made me, and it justified my anger so that I would be protected. When I came into Al-Anon, I was so angry. I was so angry with the world. It was just not a good place to be. And I only came into Al-Anon because I was going to this therapist, and she fired me. And I was really mad about that, of course. It crushed my ego. How can my therapist fire me? She's telling me my money's not good enough for her to take anymore. What she said was, Leslie, I can't help you. You need to go to Al-Anon. So I was mad about having to go to Al-Anon, but I'm like, you know, these other people have got the problem with this drinking thing. I don't know why I have to go. It's interrupting my life. I got places to be, things to do, and this is just not something I have time for. But I went anyway because my bag of tricks was up. I could not find a way to manipulate anyone any longer to get them to do what I needed to do in the way of stopping drinking. So I was very frustrated because I couldn't make this thing happen. Walked in the door of Al-Anon, very defeated, very, very deflated, and very desperate. I stuck in because what I found was some loving arms that even if I didn't say anything, they understood. If I said nothing, I could just sit there and be angry as hell or cry, and it was okay. They accepted me just where I was. So, okay, well, I guess I better hang around. I don't have any other ideas. I don't have any other tricks. I'm going to hang around. Gradually, my anger turned to hurt, and the shell and the walls that I had built started to melt. The way I looked at life before Al-Anon was that I was very much a victim, and I held on to that victimhood as a false sense of power. As long as everybody was hurting me, I stayed stuck in this place of, I am this victim, and oh, woe is me. It wasn't until I did my fourth and fifth step that I began to understand that I actually really had a part in all these people that had done me wrong in our relationships throughout my entire life. That was a little hard to handle, but, you know, I'm supposed to be giving up my own ideas and going with the program. So I just, you know, I just, okay, that's what I need to do now. So I held on to that. Then I had this opportunity to go and see this lady speak that was a Holocaust survivor. Her name is Rose Price. If you ever see her come somewhere, I would highly suggest you go see her. She's not an Al-Anon speaker, doesn't have anything to do with program, but has everything to do with program. What this woman went through and how she was able to forgive was absolutely astounding to me. The Nazis killed her entire family and she was the only one left. And she found some way to forgive the Nazis for doing this, and she was living a very productive life, so to the point that she would go around and speak about forgiveness. What she shared that day was that hatred and unforgiveness do some horrible, horrible things to us that I never really thought of before, because I thought that was my weapon to hurt the other people, so make them suffer for what I had done, for what they had done to me. And it never occurred to me that really what I was doing was hurting myself. She talked about how hatred and unforgiveness was related to cancer, how it was related to being sick. She talked about having a number of surgeries from carrying hatred around. She talked about being unable to sleep at night. She talked about how it kept her from experiencing joy and really living and not being able to experience any type of peace or serenity whatsoever. And I just really listened to that. And what I realized is that unforgiveness for me, the hatred and anger I was carrying around, was a life force that was really seriously sucking the life out of me little by little. I'd never had that realization before, ever. So it was like this light bulb moment. And what I looked at was, how is it helpful for me to be carrying around all of this? If that's the hurt it does, how is it helpful for me to be holding on to this? What am I getting out of it? And what I was getting out of it was what Barbara was talking about, a sense of protection and being able to punish other people. What I saw, though, was that those four P's are really just an illusion. It's being delusional to think that those things are really helpful, or that they, it's just false. It's an illusion. So I had to sit in that and realize that, okay, I'm at this point in my program now that I'm hurting with this forgiveness. This unforgiveness is hurting me. But I'm not quite ready. I'm not ready to let it go, because what if I let it go? I'm going to have to be in this place of vulnerableness, and I don't want to be there. I don't want to be there. But I see all the results of a lifetime of unforgiveness. I look at my mother as example, poor example, and realize she's been stuck in the bed for the past 20 years. Occasionally she'll get up and wander around a little bit, but she'll go back to bed. And I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to have that in my older years. I'm very active. I like to do lots of stuff, a lot of different interests. And I didn't want to be stuck there. So I started looking at a cost-benefit analysis. I realized that what I could do was I could hold on to the anger and resentment, or I could let it go. What I saw was that I could not have both a loving relationship with God, and I could not get in a place where I was fit to be of maximum service to God and others. I could have one or the other, but I couldn't have both. So it was time, it was the proverbial Y in the road. I had to make a decision about what I was going to do. So Jack talked a lot about decisions this morning, and my decision was simply that I needed to make a conscious decision to become vulnerable and let go of all of this. And that's what I needed to do at that point. I look at it much like a trapeze. A trapeze artist, when they are swinging from one trapeze to the other, there is no possible way you can grab onto the one that's coming towards you until you let the one go that you're hanging on to. You can't do both. You've got to make a decision. So that was my decision. And then I had to ask myself, how? How am I going to do this? What are the steps? How do I do this forgiveness thing? I have no clue. What I saw was that I didn't really have to figure it out myself. I just had to have childlike faith. I had to believe in the program and the people enough around me and my higher power enough that if I had the why, the how would come. What I realized is that I didn't even have to start out being willing to forgive. All I had to do was start out being willing to take the steps that were in front of me. I also realized that it has nothing to do with feelings whatsoever. If I sit around and wait until I feel like forgiving, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I've never felt like forgiving anybody ever for anything. So I saw that through, as I went through these steps, what was revealed to me are some things that I just took the steps to do. And did I want to do them? No. Was it hard the first time? Yes. But I had to trust, right? So these are the steps that I found that were very, very helpful for me. One, I pray daily for the person that I'm upset with. Whether I want to or not has nothing to do with it. Just do it anyway. Then I found that I needed to write the person's name down and get rid of it daily in some form or another. Then I found that I needed to write down what I would say to them in the way of, you know, just hateful mean things so that I get it out of me. But obviously I don't read it to them. But I get it out of me because it's that bad energy being stuck in me that is just not good. So I write that down. And then I need to take a step further in that I need to get very physical with getting this energy out of me, whether it be running, whether it be, well, I'm just going to tell y'all what I did most recently. In the Halloween tradition spirit, I was mad at a female in my life, so I went and bought this witch at the dollar store. And I hung her out up in the tree, and I took a baseball bat, and I put that person's face on the witch. And boy, we had a good time. Now, of course, you know, I'm telling y'all this, but, you know, that's just part of it for me. I need to do that. I need to get all that anger out of me before I can take the next step. I don't know if it works for y'all or not. I'm just telling you what has worked for me. What I also saw was if I did not take this step, what would happen is I would actually become very physically ill and I would wind up in the bed. I spent a lot of my life in the bed dealing with emotions that were just not healthy. I didn't know how, the emotions were there, I just didn't know how to deal with them. What I decided was I was not going to do that anymore because I had already let the disease of alcoholism in the way that it is in me, not others, but the way that it exhibits itself in me, I had let it steal a tremendous amount of my life, and I wasn't willing to do that anymore. So the days of being in the bed had to be over, and that's part of it, is the physical thing for me. Then my sponsor told me if I'm mad at somebody, I have to do something nice for them and don't get found out. And I was really not happy if I hear that one. That one was one of the hardest ones I did. That was extremely hard for me. Kicking and screaming, I went and did that. But I did it. I was willing to take the steps. I'm still not at the point where I feel like forgiving this person, and I'm doing all this stuff. Then I prayed to ask God to remove my resentments and my unforgiveness, and I continued to pray that. Then I made a list of what I'm grateful for about that person and how my life has been positively affected by having them in it. That one was a real game changer for me, because I can look at what I've gained from the relationship and see that it's not really a choice just to throw somebody away anymore, that it's worth it to try to work through things. So that's where I was with my actions. Throughout my time in Al-Anon, which is, I've just celebrated my fifth year, I've had four different peoples that were very close to me in Al-Anon, their immediate family members die. That was tough for me to take. That was really tough for me to take. One of them was my sponsee, and I had to wind up officiating that. I didn't have to. I officiated her funeral. Now, I had no clue about that. I'm not an ordained minister either. I had no clue what I was doing, but Barbara wrote the words, and I just talked. So that was good. Thank you. Then my sponsor at the time just passed away unexpectedly. Just one day, not even sick or anything, she just passed away unexpectedly. And I kept thinking to myself, of course I was heartbroken, but I kept thinking to myself, what good is going to come out of this? What good could possibly come out of this person passing away? I was just very confused and in shock, and I just was not handling it very well. That has to do with, in a little bit I'll tell you what happened. Okay, so I had absolutely no hope whatsoever that this forgiveness thing was going to work for me, because I knew that I had been doing all these steps and nothing was changing and nothing was changing and nothing was changing. Then I get a call at about 4:30 in the morning one morning, and my mother is in the hospital. She had taken another fall or something from her late night romps on her pills. She always falls down and winds up in the hospital. So she was in the hospital. She called about 4:30 in the morning. She was very, very frightened. She asked me, why was she in jail? What did she do wrong? And could I come help get her out? And she was crying. Usually, in the past, what would happen is, at this point, I would yell at her. I would scream at her. I would be very judgmental. And I would be very upset about her and her disease, and why doesn't she stop, and why doesn't she see what it's doing to her. At that very moment, what happened this time, though, is I actually physically felt something lift off me. And in its place came over me a warmth that I cannot describe. It's still dark out. It's not the sunshine, and I don't know what it is. But before I ever said anything back to her, that's what occurred. And in an instant, I changed. And I saw her as very vulnerable, very frightened, very sick, and very helpless. So I talked with her as if her reality, I went from where she was in her head to talking with her about what was really going on and that she was okay. I talked with her for a few minutes, and I got off the phone with her. And then I totally understood about the sponsor I had before and passing away and what good could come out of it, because I really think those two things are connected. I know for me they are, because we spent some time talking about our mother issues, and we had a lot of the same issues. And it was I don't know how they're connected. I just know that they are. So her, that was the good thing that came out of her passing, because I never, ever thought in my life, I had given up hope about being able to forgive my mother and having a decent relationship with her, because it has been really 40 plus years of very bad road for me. So that was my spiritual experience. Ralph talked this morning about us looking for those spiritual experiences and really anticipating and hoping for those. That was the most profound spiritual experience I've ever had in my life, ever. So what I learned from that was this, is that really I am free today because I was only willing, all I had to do was be willing to take the steps. I didn't have to forgive in my heart. I didn't have to do any of that. I took the steps that were laid out in front of me, and I trusted. And through the grace of God, I did what I could, and higher power did for me, picked up the rest of the way and ran with it. So that's what I've learned about forgiveness, and now I don't want to ever go back to that place. Of course, my sick head starts, you know, we'll ruminate on things. I'll start thinking that, and the minute I start doing that, I will get off that page and go back to my steps that I just went through with you, and I'll do those again, so it will just go away. So I've learned how to manage that now, and that's one of the biggest gifts this program has given to me. Thanks.
My name is Lou Kay. I am an Al-Anon member, and I am a member of the New Beginnings family group in Chattanooga, Tennessee at the East Brainerd Club. Thank you for letting me be here tonight. I might as well start off with a very blunt statement. I just happen to like alcoholics. And another thing I should say is somehow I mislearned the rules of life when I was a kid. By the time I got into Al-Anon, and I heard people keep talking about having alcoholics in their life, I didn't even get it at first. I couldn't even imagine who the alcoholics in my life were. They kept saying they had been affected by alcoholism, and I kept thinking, well, that can't be me. Well, if you don't count my granddad and my uncles and my sister, and if you don't count my two brothers, and if you don't count their kids, well, maybe there were a few alcoholics. But I never saw my mom drink, and I never saw my dad drink. It was just never something I had witnessed. And the reason that matters is one of the things that when I look back on my life, I came to Al-Anon, and I had a lot of anger and hate. I hated my mother. I had such an anger toward her that I could find no single virtue that I could list regarding my mother. And I came to Al-Anon, and I was sitting in a meeting one night. This was just an amazing thing for me. It was like a gift. I was sitting in a meeting, and I finally opened up about what had gone on with me as a kid and our family and some things that had happened. And I just shared it with the family group. And someone in that meeting said, well, didn't you say that she has been dead for like 8 years? I said, yeah. And when she died, I was at the funeral, and I was there to kick the dirt on the grave because I was so angry. They said, 8 years, and she still controls you from the grave? You've made a god out of your mother. And that statement so shocked me. And I saw the truth of it that I was stunned. I didn't even know what to do. I just went kind of into a daze, and I walked out of that meeting of the East Brainerd Club, and as I stood outside, I remember saying, Mom, I'll let you go if you'll let me go. And it was over. I was clear. It was very much like a big, wet, heavy coat on my shoulders slipping off. And I did not realize how resentment had played such an incredible part in my life. I had saved up I was so powerless, and I didn't know it, but at the time I would save up a resentment because it was like a little energy that I could grab a hold of and throw at those people when I'd see them again. But once I found freedom from this experience with my mother, I wanted to get rid of every rock I had in my backpack. I wanted to be free. For me, that was a great gift because at the time I was still struggling in Al-Anon and I was trying to find out how to apply the steps in my life. But with that one experience, I just saw the truth of it, and I've never flinched since. There have been a few times that I've had to work on the letting go of the resentment and forgiving, but it has always been well worth it. And I feel resentment-free today. I don't really have anything gnawing at me. I'm a pretty happy camper. I'll give you one other story about how I mislearned the rules of life. I was married. I was in the ministry for a number of years and decided I wasn't cut out for it. And I was pretty angry when I left the ministry and I got out of this group that I was a part of. And I got out of the marriage and I went on. And for about 10 years I was single. And during that 10-year period, I'd given up on all religious issues. I was totally out of it. And I decided the best way I could integrate into society was to go to parties. Now, when I would show up at a party, and I didn't know it at the time, I had this unerring radar, an instinct that if there were 50 people in that room, I could find her. And I dated a lot of women, and if they weren't alcoholics, they were no fun. I still look back on that, and I'm amazed at how I had no idea that that training as a child of how to interact with other alcoholics and the way things work, it's the only rules I knew, and I had to find somebody that knew how to do their part so I could do my part. It was out of my awareness. I was just doing it. Well, after dating, you know, around for a while, it dawned on me I needed to start dating classier drunks. So it made sense. They looked good. They dressed well. They had great education. They made good money. And they knew how to behave so I could be me so that I didn't really have to change. Well, I went to work at this company, and there was one woman there, and I used to just go by and look in her cube. I don't know what it was about her. I did not know anything about her as far as drinking was concerned, but something about her just fit my brain. And it turned out later on, we got married, and she's in recovery. I'm thrilled with that. There were a few years in the marriage she wasn't in recovery, and that was pretty scary. What I figured out was if you hook up with them when they're real early in their disease, you can get in on the fun part. And then when it gets bad, run. You know, I think I had the rules wrong. I don't think I understood, but this was some intuitive model. But I wasn't a real catch either. I wasn't the best catch in town. I lived a pretty wild life. I was pretty crazy. I got married, and she agreed. It took a steak with blue cheese and two bottles of wine, and I got to yes. So we got married. And for a number of years, it went really well. Finally, she progressed to the point that she needed treatment. She found her way into AA, and I found my way into Al-Anon. Well, I decided I needed to do the steps. Now, there's this step called step four, and I was really happy to rip through that. I didn't have a sponsor, but I knew I could do it. And there was a step five that came right after that, and I thought, well, I'm a creative guy. Who do I care about more than this person I've married? I'm going to do my step five with my wife. And I have talent. We were going to go from Chattanooga to Johnson City. It's only 3 hours up and 3 hours back. Why not do this in the car? You see the brilliance here. It could be intimate all the way up and all the way back. And we'd have plenty of time to cover everything. And so I thought absolute honesty would be great virtue here. I had not been a faithful husband, but I wanted to make sure I told all. But it didn't turn out well, just so you'll know. surprise, surprise. When we got back, I was talking to several of the people back at the East Brainerd Club, and what they gave me was some advice, and I've held on to it ever since. One was, absolute honesty without wisdom is brutality. I needed a sponsor, someone that was not going to be affected by the very things we were talking about. Secondly, I can't do the steps by myself. I need adult supervision. The last thing we need in my life is my creativity guiding my recovery. So I'm very happy to have a sponsor now that has walked that road long enough and seen enough to give me great coaching, and it's been very, very good for me in the last couple of years. I will say that regarding my fifth step, my wife has been very gracious about that. She goes to meetings. She's heard me share my story publicly, as I'm sharing some of it here. And the only time that she's ever said anything, and this is just my interpretation. By the way, I'll say this. It's funny how the stories I tell have changed since I found recovery. It's the same stories, but somehow they're different. It's almost like the spin has changed. I used to tell the story so I could be the victim, and today I tell the story because I am no longer a victim. The same facts, the same story, a whole different understanding of what went on. I am elated with the changes. One night we were talking at the house, and my wife said, you know, you go to a lot of meetings. You're gone all the time. You come in late at night. I feel disconnected from you. What would I need to do for you to feel connected? And she said, maybe if you would call me when you leave to go to a meeting, and you call me when you get ready to depart and come back home. And I got to thinking, after that fifth step, I don't blame her for wanting to know every single place I am. And so I do, to this day. I call my wife every time I go to a meeting, and I say, I'm at such and such a location, I'm on this spot in the road, I'm driving down the road. That's as close as I can make to an amends to my wife. And I'm going to go back and close out my first story with my mother. Not only did I find freedom from the resentment with my mother when that was left, I felt I needed to make an amends to my mother too. Let me give you the amends as I have it today. I was pretty convinced my mother was Hitler, or maybe worse. She just really gave me a lot of grief when I was a kid growing up. Enough so my dad came to me one day because I was going to leave the house and not come back. And he said, son, if you'll just stay until you graduate from high school, I'll help you leave. I know how tough it is. So I stayed. And I really was glad my dad said that to me. It was very gracious of him to help me. But here's my amends. My mother was not that harsh. She changed my diapers. She fed me. When I was sick, she was there for me. And this is a family disease. It gets passed down. Her dad was an alcoholic. He beat her one time with a fire poker so bad that she was bedridden. When she was in the fifth grade, my mother was pulled out and put to work in a cotton mill. When she finally left home, she had to marry someone to get out of that house. She married an alcoholic. She had three kids with that man, and he started bringing other women to the house. In the 1940s, it was an incredible thing of courage to get a divorce. As a woman, it was just tough in the South to do that. She felt that's what she had to do. She got out of that marriage. My mother had her own courage, and even though she did not know what she was passing down, and the training that she was unintentionally passing down, it's just the way the disease works if you don't find help. I'm lucky I'm in Al-Anon. I found help when I could not have found it any other way. And today, I can tell you this. If my mother was here, I would say these things so she could hear me say them. And as far as church and God is concerned, about 2 years ago, I had what I believe was an awakening. There is a God. It's very personal. I'm so fortunate that I found something that I never had found. And the difference for me today and from then was, when I was tied up as a pastor, I never changed on the inside. Some part of me was frozen and brittle and never changed. In this program, I no longer feel frozen. There's nothing brittle, and I welcome change. I am very grateful to be a member of Al-Anon. Thank you.
I round up with just a couple quick things of my own. I was raised in active alcoholism. My parents were both adult children. I come from three grandparents who were alcoholic. I spent every weekend with my grandmother. And, you know, there was a point in time where it seemed to be helpful to me to see myself as a victim. My grandmother, you know, I spent every weekend with my grandmother. The first thing we did every Saturday morning was go to the liquor store. I have memories in liquor stores beginning at 4. And we didn't go to just one, we went to 3 because she said we were bargain shopping. But, you know, every activity that I did with my grandmother was around alcohol. You know, she would have her 3 martini lunch. I would have my 3 Shirley Temple lunch. You know, we would come back and unpack the trunk of liquor. She would have her drinks. I would have my cheese sandwich, and she would pass out somewhere along the line. She'd take me out to honky-tonks with her at night. I'd try to sleep on a beer-soaked floor. You know, there was a period of time that it felt comfortable to cloak myself in this adult child, you know, wounded person scenario. But I kind of like what Dolly Parton said, get down off the cross, somebody needs the wood. You know, being a martyr hurt nobody but me. Being able to see my grandmother for who she was and the alcoholism she came from that Lou talked about, it's long held in both my parents' family. And letting go of that past and being willing to change. The amends that I made to my grandmother by the time she had passed on, by the time I was ready to make amends to her, so I wrote her a letter. And I share this because I know there's somebody in here who needs to forgive someone who's dead. And I wrote a letter to her, and I wrote all the fun times, because she was kind of wacky when, you know, some of the ideas she'd come up with to find a drink during the day when she was with her grandmother, some of them were fun. And all the fun things I remembered about my grandmother, my sadness in recognizing her problem was alcoholism, and my regret for not being there for her when she really needed me. You know, as she got older, I did everything I could to avoid her. And I took a friend, and I went to her grave, and I read the letter there, and I tore it up in little bitty pieces, and I mixed it with some potting soil, and I planted a camellia bush there at her grave because that was her favorite plant, favorite flower. And I watered it with a few of my own tears and some water that I had brought with me. And I still try to go to her grave when the camellias bloom, because it helps me remember that when I'm able to let something go, something beautiful can bloom at this place. I had a roommate, college roommate, hadn't been able to find her. I thought I was off the hook. Looked everywhere for trying to find forgiveness for this roommate. I'd moved out on her when she was at work one day. We had had an argument over a guy. I didn't leave a forwarding address. I didn't leave her the rent that was due the next day. I didn't leave her anything. I just took off. And I called the phone numbers I had for her, the phone numbers for her mother, the alumni association, the school we went to, and no phone number. I thought I was off the hook. Was on vacation in a state that I'd never been to, in a mall, and I saw her walking down the mall the other way. And they say when you're ready to make amends, sometimes that person just shows up. And so I crossed in my part of the road. I saw her, walked over to the other side of the mall, started telling her about being in Al-Anon, that I knew I owed her an amends. I looked in my wallet. I had about the amount of money I thought I probably owed her. I pulled it out. You know, I gave her one of my business cards, you know, said, I really am really sorry for everything. And she never said a word. She just stared at me like this. And for a minute, I wondered if it was her. But it was. And about a year later, she called me. And she said, Barbara, you'll never know what a gift you gave me that day. said I had canceled all kinds of people out of my life. She hadn't talked to her mother in over 10 years. And she said she had called her mother. She had a renewed relationship with her mother. She wanted to send me some of the money back because I did not owe her that much, and we're now on each other's Christmas card list. So sometimes forgiveness can pay forward. You know, God can take those experiences and make them more than we ever imagined. Freedom, you know, the freedom not to get stuck in pain is tremendous. I think I said this yesterday, but, you know, resentment, holding on to unforgiveness is like us drinking the poison and waiting for the other person to die. You know, we're making our own self sick. We're not getting better. The miracle of this process is freedom. You know, if I am not willing to forgive somebody, I've given, just like Lou said, I've given my power over to them. You know, I've let them continue to manipulate my life, even if it's from the grave. And it's all about self-esteem for us to be willing to forgive others. And hey, you know, sometimes the miracle happens on the other end. If we're willing to do the work we need to do to make amends, sometimes we actually receive forgiveness on the other side. Sometimes we don't. I have a girl who's announced to me she has implacable resentment and not to ever expect her to forgive me. And it's not even a big thing. I still pray for her every day. You know, the writing names down and getting rid of them is something I learned and passed on. You know, I've had, and it's interesting when I give that assignment to somebody I sponsor, how they get rid of it changes with time. Okay? I've had sponsees that start off writing on toilet paper. I have one who's been writing names on raw eggs and throwing them at trees recently. But, you know, by the time that they're writing them on pieces of paper and attaching them to a helium balloon or finding an opportunity to go to the ocean and write them in the sand, something miraculous happens. I hope that whoever that name was, whoever those people were that you thought of when we started today, that you will take some of the wisdom that's been shared here today and give yourself a chance and them a chance to have a renewed relationship. And I thank you. We're going to...